Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, a year of the yellow vests. We go to Paris to talk to Thibaut Devienne, someone who's been involved in the protests right from the start. What are the yellow vests actually fighting for? We ask him also about the use of agents provocateurs and how the protests have been used to turn peaceful protesters into criminals. Also, founder of the UK 9/11 Truth Movement, Ian Neal, looks at the 7/7 London bombings and also the media role in perpetrating the war on terror. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen and paper ready at the end of the show.
My name is Thibaut Devienne. I'm 24 years old currently, and I'm a yellow vest in France. I've been involved into local politics since I was about 15 years old. I was working at the start of a movement as a teacher, private teacher, for disadvantaged kids, and I continued on in order to become a full-time yellow vest, also working as a part-time independent reporter now, in order to support the movement since it started.
Can you tell us something about the arrival of President Macron and how that changed? I mean, it's great that you're, as a young man, you're getting involved in politics even at a young age. But what was it like to have Macron appear, and where did he come from?
It would be actually, it was said many times that Macron came from nowhere. That's not really quite the case, actually. It was part, despite the fact that he was labeled as brand new and, such an original political product that it was supposed to be, bright and young and the future of French politics. It was actually part of Hollande's cabinet beforehand. He was the finance minister of France for quite a bit of time, really, before being laid off in order to prepare, truthfully, what he had already planned as being his professional, top-notch presidential political career. It would be, it's not a beginner whatsoever regarding politics. He was advertised as such, of course, because after the awful, god-awful 5 years of the previous President François Hollande, people wanted a change, and that change was advertised by the general medias in France, but in the Western world in general, as the change. Emmanuel Macron, a young stud coming from a non-political background that was supposed to turn France around. And despite the fact that French people had a bit of reluctancy buying that version of history, most doubted that, especially considering, the fact that he was part of François Hollande's cabinet, he got served by very persistent propaganda from the same medias that had already chosen him, that were faithful to him, and that advertised him. I think it was the subject of, 1,800 articles in the small year that it took to prepare the presidential election. So it was really advertised, in order to gather a lot of votes, and that's eventually what happened. As some of you might know, the French presidential elections are in two rounds. What happened is he went on against a candidate, which is, of course, Marine Le Pen of the National Front. Marine Le Pen from the National Front isn't that popular in France. And, it's always the same tune in France. When the National Front comes into the second round, we know perfectly that no political party whatsoever is going to actually make an alliance with her. So the National Front, despite being the first political party, actually most French people didn't vote or choose not to vote during those elections. National Front comes second. Macron ends up against the National Front, but of course, because most people would rather, even despite not voting Macron during the second round, would better have him instead of the National Front. Macron got elected, I have to admit that I was not very impressed by that election, like most French people. We're talking about a guy that basically had, you know, one of the lowest confidence rates coming into office during the Fifth Republic in France. Less than 5% of France's public opinion trusted him with a presidential, with actually being fit for the post, despite him coming in as president, due to lack of, you know, decisive aspects of the French presidential system. So I think Macron went on a bad start, you know, from the start, actually, from getting into office. And he has just confirmed that negative aspect of his since he came into action 2 years ago, a bit less than 2 years ago, actually.
Okay, so, I mean, the Yellow Vest protests apparently started because of some kind of a fuel tax. Macron is imposing this because he is trying to bring France along the road of you know, the low carbon country. Now, surely this is something which has been agreed in Paris and other places. Internationally, we need to bring down our emissions. And he's just simply doing what has been agreed internationally. And yet some people like yourself in France appear to have be saying, no, this is wrong. And we have to really break this agreement that has been made around, mostly around the Western world, because the Chinese are not playing ball here to reduce the threat of pollution and climate change.
Okay, I understand your question. The thing is, I think it's quite clear that no one, I hope at least in this world, and especially in France, stands against ecology. You know, we are we're all, you know, nationwide. Ecology stands as, you know, the environment, the current situation with the environment is, of course, an important matter. Emmanuel Macron's stance on that subject, I think it is quite dubious, and I'm going to tell you why. The thing with Emmanuel Macron is that his so-called ecology bills seem to always fit with his agenda on imposing taxes on the French middle class. We're talking about someone who openly promotes an open society with, you know, not only mass migration, but someone who sees, you know, globalization, economic globalization as a positive thing. So we're going to have fruits, vegetables coming through naval structures, coming through our ports instead of being grown here in France. We're going to have huge sums of planes flying from and to France, which have basically, virtually, which are not being taxed at all, thanks to EU's law, because, of course, Emmanuel Macron, unlike you guys in England, strongly believes in the EU. And at the same time, someone who promotes a so-called you know, environmental-friendly agenda on imposing always the French middle class, this fuel tax... I understand the whole bit about, you know, environmental friendly, one planet at all. This fuel tax was especially aimed at the French middle class in order to gather more taxes. So we're talking about a country where, for example, in Paris, if you have a car that dates back to, I think it's more than 15 years ago, you're not supposed to enter Paris because it's considered to be too not environmental and not pro-environment enough.
Okay, you know? Well, that is that's an interesting idea, isn't it? Because what they're then saying is that if you have an older car, in other words, maybe you don't have much money, you've had to buy it for a few hundred pounds in English money, you have a cheaper car, then you can't come into Paris. But if you have a brand new car, maybe an enormous engine, whatever, then that's fine, you can come in. So this seems to be a regressive tax.
Well, that's actually okay with him. So that wasn't the tax promoted by Emmanuel Macron, just an example, coming from his government, coming from his political party, coming from his political agenda. But that's the whole thing in France. You know, it's nice to promote, of course, being environmentally friendly. It's nice to promote, you know, warnings against climate change and to use that agenda against other presidents, et cetera, like Mr. Trump. The thing is, there's not a single tax revenue. We're talking about someone who openly promotes maritime transport, seafood transport, you know, even aeroplanes, etc., which do not pay as much taxes, despite being way more concerning regarding the environment. We're talking here about a tax that's going to affect everyone, because, of course, people in the big city, people in Paris, in Marseille, they can use public transport really easily. And they use it quite a lot in order to go to work, in order to move around in general, etc. People in, you know, small cities, people in rural areas are not able to use these solutions. Plus, they are usually people with a much lower revenue. So it's not a matter of being environmental friendly or not. If to be a good green citizen, you have to buy a car that's going to maybe cost, you know, 50,000 euros. Well, most French people, around 99% of French people, they can't afford that, of course. So, you know, Macron uses this stance as an excuse to promote his economic agenda. Because it, of course, it's not going to put taxes on, the social economic elite in France, which roots for him, votes for him, made him into what he is today. You know, he was built from the start by this financial elite. You know, he's a banker. He comes from the banking world, and like most political candidates in France or previous presidents, who at least have a decency, you know, to hide these ties with and their financial background. He doesn't, you know. He was openly promoted as such. And so we're talking about a tax that's going to affect the worker in rural areas that has to go to work by car every day. That is not going to affect, of course, the people who could pay these taxes the most, you know, the upper class in the cities.
What's happened in France? Because you're saying that Hollande was a disaster, Macron is a disaster. Is the Fifth Republic failing?
Well, the Fifth Republic has been failing for a long time. I think it's a complex question as well. A very complex question, because we've been also, you know, since President Mitterrand a bit more than 20 years ago now, the Fifth Republic, unfortunately, you can't blame everything on French institutions and the Fifth Republic. Those institutions worked perfectly when they were managed by very honorable men, like, of course, everybody now in France has, sees the Fifth Republic in a good view when it's de Gaulle, when it's Hollande, when it's recent presidents. It's a bit less evident, of course. I don't think the Fifth Republic is solely to blame. I think that the common stance that was taken by the political elite to go further down the path of of the EU losing our sovereignty has a lot to do with it. You know.
So I mean, it sounds like you're implying that the yellow vests are anti-Brussels. Is that the case? Is that a formal position?
There are many positions with the Yellow Vest. I would believe, yeah, if you were to interact with most people within the Yellow Vest movement, most of them would be anti-Brussels, yeah, surely. It was not made official because, of course, the Yellow Vest is not an organized protest, as you might know. Everyone comes with his own specific, you know, IDs and backgrounds. Of course, there are IDs that are more represented and that are more in line with what the movement is talking about and is hoping for.
Well, that's a problem, though, isn't it? Because you've got to have some kind of alignment of demands. Otherwise, how can you achieve anything with the Yellow Vest protests?
So that's an interesting question, because that has a lot to do with the start of the movement, what it started as. The Yellow Vest movement didn't start, unlike most, you know, you hear about demonstrations in France over time. That's one of the original aspects of the French Yellow Vest. It was born out of anger, it was born out of despair, it was born out of misery, and it started more as a global, let's say, protest without any specific political aims than, you know, an organized movement with a leader, with a perspective, with a full-on program. And from this base, the Yellow Vest evolved, you know, weeks after weeks, months after months, building sort of a list of things to obtain top, you know, advanced ID is the what's known in France as the RIC, which is the direct referendum from the people. We've been, you know, last referendum to happen in France was in 2005. It was the French people stood against at the time. It was about the EU. The French people stood against the Rome meeting. And of course, they were denied in 2008 by President Sarkozy. They were denied a decision despite them voting against it.
Okay, this is the EU constitution, I think, isn't it? And then it's interesting because they framed it as the EU constitution, many countries had plebiscites on it, or referenda on it. And then it came back again as something called the Lisbon Treaty, because a treaty doesn't have to have a referendum, even though actually the text of it was pretty much the same. So what happened in 2005? Was that result rejecting the constitution, was that just ignored by the government?
At the time, no, of course. The government had no choice, you know, but to go with what the French people had decided. But as you mentioned, yeah, the Lisbon Treaty in 2000, which came in fruition in 2008, which is exactly the same treaty. And it's not me talking about it. Actually, previous French president, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, which was a founder of, one of the founders, at least, of the European Parliament, said that on a national radio in France, and everybody went with it. So last time there was a referendum in France, my point is, last time there was one in France, it was completely denied. So one of the main remarks, one of the main wishes of these protests, Yellow Vest protests now, has been to implement into the constitution directly the possibility to have, with, I think, the possibility to choose a law from the people, by the people, without going through parliament, without going through, because a few referendums that we indeed had in France were chosen by the government.
Well, I think that might be something that people in Britain would recognise, because obviously we've had a bit of problem with the parliament here ignoring the request from the Brexit referendum in the UK. Anyway, so yes. What about other demands? Because obviously that's one. But I mean, is there any kind of wider vision? Because this is one of the things which I know the French are actually quite good at, which is creating a united front to bring lots of people together under one banner. Now, have the Yellow Vests managed to achieve that, or is that still work in progress?
So, we're talking about a movement that has 1 year of existence. Actually, we celebrated that birthday last Sunday. So we're talking about a rather young movement, of course, politically speaking, especially considering the fact that, unlike most political protests in the past, it wasn't the product of a specific political party. It wasn't the product of a workers' union or anything like that. It was a product purely of the people, not very politically educated people, might I add, and I definitely, I'm part of that. I fit in that. The thing is, at first, the Yellow Vest movement was all about, you know, kicking out Macron, the RIC. It was all under a common banner. And, you know, you could find, and that was also one of the most refreshing aspects of these protests. You could find in these protests, you know, people going alongside, getting together, talking about politics, etc., working together in order to achieve this goal of kicking Macron out, of achieving the RIC. You could find anarchists, you could find socialists, you could find people who had no political identity whatsoever. You could have people who voted for the National Front. You even had people who voted for Macron, as surprising as it sounds. So you would find it would be an amalgamation of every. It was a French, basically, to speak the truth. It didn't have anything to do with a special, you know, policy or a special agenda. It was the French people revolting. So that was the situation, you know, in maybe December last year, January last year. Since that, many political parties have tried, you know, to infiltrate this purely non-partisan movements and turn it into something completely different. Of course, you have left-wing like parties like what we call in France La France Insoumise, which is like extreme left-wing political party, which got involved with the protest despite seeing it at first as some product of right-wing policies, which is kind of funny if you consider it. And you know, every political party has tried to tear that apart basically and to change it into something that it's not. Meaning the left is going to say that, of course, the yellow vests, they root for, you know, against global warming, against, you know, for the proletariat, which is, of course, you know, which has some truth in it. But at the same time, you're going to have, you know, nationalists, right wingers, which are going to say, yeah, it's all about immigration, et cetera. It's all about going against the EU. It's all about France's identity, which it is a bit as well. So, unfortunately, unity has been a bit shattered because of that, because of this involvement, constant involvement and constant work, underground work of these political parties and union workers.
I mean, it's almost as if there were attempts to undermine the movement by the opposition, which, of course, is trying to divide French society into rich and poor, feed the rich, starve the poor, and they will not want this kind of thing to happen. I mean, there is a list which is 25 demands, including economy and work, politics, health and environment, foreign affairs. I'm just going to read out some of the demands. This is on signsofthetimes.net. That's www.sott.net. Has an article saying this is from last year, actually. This time last year, saying this is a manifesto put out by some of the yellow vests. And I just want to see if you recognise it. A constitutional cap on taxes, 25%. An increase of 40% in the basic pension and social welfare. Increased hiring in the public sector. Massive construction projects to house 5 million homeless. Severe penalties for any cities that leave people on the streets. The breakup of the banks, too big to fail banks, to re-separate high street banking from casino banking and investment banking, and also cancelling debts accrued through high rates of interest. Now, I don't know if that's been agreed amongst all the yellow vests, but it certainly would make sense to quite a lot of people reading it, saying, well, all that, you know, would actually create a better country. So is that something you recognise, those demands?
Personally, on a personal level, I would agree with most of these demands, especially the one regarding the debt. The thing about those demands and the thing that's a bit of an issue with the yellow vests in general that we also need to tackle as yellow vests. Many committees were formed, many local regional committees were formed, and of course they hold assemblies, you know, in which the people get to talk and in which they're going to try to process through specific demands, et cetera, et cetera. The problem with the yellow vest movements is, and has always been the same, is that it is a tactic called leaderless resistance. And since it doesn't have a central committee, since it doesn't have a leader, since it doesn't have, you know, broad political thinkers, the thing is you're going to get very various demands, some which most yellow vests would completely disagree on, some that most yellow vests would completely agree with, some demands that do not fit, of course, the reality of global
politics. Okay, so the disadvantage of that is a bit disorganized, but the advantage is that the authorities cannot sort of take the head off the pyramid, because there is no head of the pyramid. So look, going down to the brass tacks here, Thibault, there's been between something like 10 to 15 deaths over the last year. I mean, how has that happened? Because there's not been actually that much coverage in Britain. We're only, 10, 15 miles away across the channel. How have these deaths come about? Because surely the police have to police these protests in a way which doesn't lead to people dying.
So this is where also we're touching on a difficult subject. Of course, these numbers, they vary from, as you said, from 10 to 15. Some people count more, some people count less. It's hard to pin down a specific number. what's happening in France and like in most countries in Europe is that there are two aspects, the tactic that was given to the police and the traditional police tactics. So unlike most European countries, in France, when rioters happen to be within a protest where the police is going to try to arrest them, in France, a protest is treated as a mass. So the police is going to basically launch tear gas, shoot at the protesters. And when I say shoot, I mean literally not with guns, but with the infamous LBDs, which are guns with rubber bullets, were actually condemned, I think, by the UN. That shouldn't be used in France. There are still. So the police force is going to see that protest as a mass. So despite the fact that you have very peaceful people going there, they are going to be faced with police brutality eventually if they can't move too fast, because there is not this idea that, you know, we need to take the rioters out. Of course, this is also part of a political agenda. And you know, I have a very concrete example of that. Last week, we were having a demonstration in Paris, which I was, of course, part of, celebrating the 1 year in existence of the movement. Some rioters managed to come to this protest, despite the fact that most people, me included, had to go through several police checks before checking in. So this is where there's a bit of an incoherence. That protest became very violent very early on.
Okay, can you give us an idea of how many people were there?
Oh, it's hard to say how many people were in Paris, because we got scattered very early due to this police force, due to these police tactics. I think there was more than 15,000 people in Paris, which is not a lot compared to the general French population, but of course most people are afraid of going to these protests because of police violence.
So what happened when the rioters turned up?
Allow me to put the emphasis on the fact that there were several police checks, and yet some people were, you know, got their water bottle confiscated. And at the same time, we're talking about people who are dressed fully in black, who can manage to go through these police checks without a wound, without getting arrested, without anything. And these people have, you know, weapons. Some of them have weapons.
What sort of weapons?
So it's going to be crowbars. It's going to be tactical masks in order to avoid the gas, which I was denied one, and most people got denied one. It's going to be for the crowbars in order to, of course, take the pavement out and throw it at the police. So these kind of weapons, we're not talking about guns, of course, or some have some knives. I've seen that. And yet they, you know, strolled through the police check. So this is a moment where we need to address the fact that Macron loves this kind of scene because, of course, it has several advantages. First off, it allows to take, you know, really convincing pictures, really convincing videos showing that, yes, of course, these demonstrators, you know, they are violent. They are the violent kind, and they fight against police. They, you know, so you shouldn't go there. It serves as a basis to use that to his advantage in order also to divide the people, to give a bad image of the movements, despite the fact that it's still overwhelmingly popular in France and supported by the masses, quite frankly. the purpose of that is also that it allows Macron to disallow, to pronounce these demonstrations illegal. Last week, we had a legal demonstration, which you need to go through a complex process in order to validate the fact that these demonstrations are going to happen and that they're possible. One of my personal friends went to Paris in order to do this process, and this protest, this demonstration was completely legal. It was made illegal at the last second, 20 minutes beforehand precisely, and not a single policeman bothered to actually tell the people there that it has been made illegal and that they need to get out of there, unlike the normal procedure. Only the people who were responsible with this demonstration got the news that it had been made illegal. And of course, meaning that day, if you wanted to celebrate in legal, peaceful way, the 1 year celebration of the movement and keep on fighting, you had no choice but to go to your place because there was no legal demonstration available in Paris. So we are talking about imagine a country, you know, you have to, in order to demonstrate against the government that you claim to fight, you have to first off validate the fact from you have to get the authorization from the government, from the prefecture, which goes hand in hand with Macron in order to fight against it. And at the last time they're talking about, they're deleting that possibility of fighting it legally without violence. They're deleting that. So imagine if something like that would happen in Russia. Imagine for a second if something like that would happen in Poland. We would be talking about complete dictatorship. Yes, this is what's currently happening in France.
Well, I mean, it's worth remembering, Thibault, that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights does actually guarantee the civic right of assembly. This is one of the basic rights in the Universal Declaration, which was signed by all member states of the United Nations after the Second World War, really as a kind of lesson to try and make sure that the problems that led to the Second World War couldn't happen again. The right to peaceful assembly is really a very basic human right, but it sounds to me like that right doesn't exist in Paris.
And you are absolutely right. It does exist. And we're, especially when we talk about France, we're talking about the country that believes, that is supposed to believe that to the core. If I remember correctly, Emmanuel Macron actually, when the crisis happened last year in Venezuela, said clearly that the people should have the right to demonstrate, yet is not doing that. He's doing the opposite in his own country in order to save himself. What they get you with in France, what actually happened to me on a number of occasions, is that despite the supposedly universal rights, you're going to go to Paris, you're going to a protest, and if there's not a legal protest, which, you know, shouldn't be a thing, a protest is, if it's violent, is supposed to be legal. They're going to give you a fine, explaining that you're a threat to national security, and that's what happened to me on a number of occasions. So when talking about the Yellow Vests, we're talking about people which, most of the time, they don't have a lot of money. So that's also one of the tactics that the government is keen on using.
Okay, so how much do they fine you, Thibault?
So it's precisely 133 euros per time they are going to fine you. So I think I got four or five of these. So imagine just how much it costs. Yeah.
So what exactly did you do to deserve those fines?
Well, I remember clearly the first time I had a French flag on my back, which apparently, without even a yellow vest. No, it's even more than that. It's even weirder than that. The first time I got caught, so to speak, by the police force, and they gave me a fine, I was with a friend walking near the Arc de Triomphe, going to a legal protest, going to a protest that, you know, that was organized and that had the authorization of the civil authorities. I was walking to get there and I was stopped by a policeman who recognized me as being part of the Yellow Vest. I didn't have my Yellow Vest on, despite the fact that it would be completely legal to have so. And I was stopped, and even despite the fact that there were two of us going to this protest, we were fined because we were next to the Arc de Triomphe, 135 euros. And these cases, some of them are just absolutely ridiculous. But at the same time, you know, that's their tactic. It's like, you want to protest against me? Okay, so let's go. So I'm going to put the police against you, which the police weren't supposed to be against us. You know, they have tough living conditions as well. And, you know, despite the fact that we've got major issues with the police, they have tough living conditions as well. It's a very, it's very difficult work, and we can sympathize with that. I definitely do. Actually, it's funny to notice that at the same time, the police is launching mass protests in France on the 5th of December, which is going to have a nationwide impact. So they will use the police against you. They will use police brutality. They're going to harm you with tear gas, with rubber bullets, with every tactic in the book. You name it, they have it. if it doesn't work, they're going to fine you, expecting you not to be able to pay. And after that, well, you know, you just have to forget the fact that you're a free citizen. You can just stay home and protest from your keyboard. And of course, if they take you too many times, I had friends of mine, you know, comrades of mine, who were denied the right to go to a demonstration by the police, despite the fact that they have done nothing wrong. Actually, one of my very good friend, and Yellow Vest, you know, was denied the right to go to these protests, despite the fact that he's a veteran, you know, who fought for France. He has good ties with the police. He always sympathized with them, never threw a rock against them, never threw anything against them, never threw a fit. He doesn't have the right anymore. He was fined by the police, and he doesn't have the right anymore to participate in those demonstrations.
Okay, so look, whereabouts do you think these demonstrations are heading? Now we're a year into them. What for the next months? Do you think there's going to be some achievements and change, or do you think maybe the tactics are going to work and the French people are going to give up trying to get rid of Macron?
You know, of course, it would take a very wise man to see what's coming next, which I'm not that that much that wise, but I think these tactics, they tend to be very efficient, and we can see that despite the fact that the massive amounts, the majority of French people really sympathize with the movement, and you can see that as a yellow vest, you know, when you wear the yellow vest, you get all sorts of comments from the people who don't go to the demonstrations, and they are really supportive of that. Despite that, most people are frightened by the amount of violence that they see, of course, during those demonstrations. You know, you have to take into account the fact that going to these demonstrations, you know, you were talking before about the number of people who were killed within, you know, during those demonstrations. You have to talk about the awful amounts of people who lost an eye, who lost an arm, who lost a hand, who lost, you know, who became completely handicapped due to police violence. And of course, you know, not many people are willing to go to these demonstrations if it means, you know, that it doesn't achieve anything, because Emmanuel Macron has done nothing to answer the people's call, of course, for more than a year now. And he's not going to do anything. I don't see why he should. You know, it doesn't fit with his personality. So many people are afraid. Many people are losing hope. Many people are afraid of getting fined as well. They are afraid of getting in trouble with the police. I've had one instance. Also, one of my friends who's a bit of an older gentleman. He needs to take care of his father, and he was just informed 2 days ago that he was going to lose the custody of his father, which is handicapped and very old, you know, because of his participation with his protest and because of the fact that he was arrested by the police.
So it sounds to me like Macron has nearly won.
Macron, I don't think that the end of the Yellow Vests, and we shouldn't talk about the end of the Yellow Vests just right now. I think there's part of this movement that, due to the severe tactics, due to this severe police brutality, has hardened. And most of them are not willing to let go of this movement.
It does sound to me as if maybe those protests are moving a bit closer to Macron, and that may make a difference.
We all started out, me included, as beginners in a way, you know, if there's such a thing in politics. We all started out because of disbelief, because of frustration, because of poverty, because of daily difficulties, and the fact that we saw that the government and previous governments as well have nothing to do with it, and they don't want to improve the situation. So we started out 1 year ago with no experience whatsoever, you know, in running a demonstration, in running a protest, in communication. We don't have, and of course, the French medias, the French news sources are not here to help. And that's why I'm thankful that independents such as yourself, you know, they get the job done. And of course, throughout this year, we acquired several tactics, a bit of more knowledge, and we improved regarding our status as what we can only be seen as, you know, political fighters, you know, because that's what we are, unfortunately. We saw that elections did nothing to change. We saw that so-called elected political power, you know, like Macron is supposed to be, is not going to change anything, that he follows the EU's policy. And so we have to take care of things, you know, we have to take this matter with our own hands, basically. We have to take care of this matter. And I think most of us have acquired specific skills and experience that we didn't have a year ago. So that's why I'm very hopeful that eventually we're going to win. I'm very hopeful that these governments will go away and that these EU's puppets and financial puppets will finally manage to get rid of them, because they have been plaguing France's, not only France's economy, but French, the French society, for way longer than expected. You know, and we need to get rid of them if we want to survive as a nation, if we want to survive as a people, because it's only going to get worse.
Okay, Thibault, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now to one of the founders of the UK 9/11 Truth Movement, who died last year, Ian Neil. An interview I did with him in June 2018. Here he looks at the 7/7 London bombings and the media's role in perpetuating the war on terror.
So, well, a few years later, 4 years later, Britain had its own serious terrorist attack on the 7/7 London bombings. Yeah. 50 people killed, plus allegedly 4 suicide bombers. Yeah. And this also had a similar sort of effect, because it brought in new government powers around surveillance, this sort of thing. Yeah. And actually, this seems to be a pattern with these major terrorist attacks. I mean, that seems to be one of the parts of these, is whether you agree with the official story or not, is that there's an enormous amount more civil liberties given up by the people, and more taken, power taken by the security services, which are largely in Britain unaccountable. That means to say that there isn't anybody democratically elected really overseeing what they do at all. There really isn't. Nobody. So anyway, what about the London bombings?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that also tells us about... I mean, just to respond to you how we had a wave of civil liberties restraining legislation after 7/7. Same was true, of course, in the United States with the Patriot Act. That came into force weeks after the event, to the extent that there's no way that document could have been written in response to 9/11. It had to be in place already, and it was rushed through Congress and the Senate and passed into war with no sort of testing of the legislation at all. In response to 7/7, though, it also, you know, we shouldn't forget, okay, look at the investigation into Grenfell Tower. Nobody has drawn the links to how that tower is still standing after being a blazing inferno for hours. Okay, it's not the same type of structure, but making the connection to the supposed fire-induced collapses of the towers is just... well, it's interesting, the contrast of the level of investigation into Grenfell, and then you compare it to 7/7. No public inquiry. Question, you know, clear inconsistencies not picked up by the media. And it's not to, you don't have to go down say exactly what happened. You have to identify the areas whereby the official story just cannot be true. You know, as a case in point, the official narrative, which the government published in response for the calls for a official account of what had happened, told stories about the bombers supposedly catching a certain train which was cancelled. You know, and getting that type of detail wrong, bearing in mind that train would have been packed, yeah, with morning commuters. So to get the detail of what time that train was caught, how is that possible, when you, given you've got hundreds of witnesses that...
Well, it does imply that the detectives looking into it and the anti-terrorist branch they were simply looking at a timetable rather than going to interview Thameslink or whoever it was, or passengers who had been there at the time.
Well, yes, and it does point to that type of detail, the witness statements that the floor in the carriages where the bombs supposedly were showed evidence that the explosion was upwards, that the bombs were underneath the carriage, which is completely inconsistent. I'm not saying exactly what happened, but if you'd had a public inquiry, you undoubtedly would have got to the bottom of all these questions. You would have had transparency.
Yeah, but we did have an inquest, didn't we?
Not a public inquiry.
It was an inquest.
Oh, sorry. We are talking many, many years after, when the cases went to court, yeah? But well, maybe you can correct me, but I don't remember a public inquiry into 70.
No, there was no public inquiry. No. There was an inquest. The only thing is, an inquest is really designed for a single suspicious death. Yeah. Here we've got 54 suspicious deaths, and also that it was heard without a jury. So, anyway, look, what about, surely there will be, there needs to be normal judicial process. It doesn't look as if that's happened either in the UK or in America.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, like I say, to me, our message is to convince people that the official story of 9/11 and many other similar events which have had catalysing effects do not add up. And then rest there and say, okay, let's open up these subjects to scrutiny and to proper inquiry, and let the testimony show the actual truth. But at the moment, everything is done in secrecy. Case, you know, the testimony at the official 9/11 inquiry was given in private, especially the case of Bush and Mumsfeld, who gave it in secret and not on record and not under oath. So if you get a movement behind lots of large-scale investigations, and let's face it, our politics today is filled with these events. Let's take the child abuse inquiry, which has gone nowhere, and of which evidence for which keeps getting lost. Theresa May pay attention, Ian Duncan Smith pay attention. So there's another example where there's a huge conspiracy and cover-up of long-term institutional sexual abuse. I believe that will come out in a proper inquiry. Hillsborough, Orgreave, many, many other instances, the spy cops, for example. Oh, no, 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 no. If I had more thought, I'd probably reel off another 20 issues. All of these things, I want to unite people, and it's not about uniting. This isn't a left or right thing. It's about the rule of law, truth, and whether our society is run by psychopaths or is run by the people for the people.
But surely, I mean, with all these failures in the judiciary, surely at least someone somewhere in the mass media would pick this up, make programmes about it, that sort of thing?
Well, that's what I would hope. If you've got enough people to look at the evidence and previous events where the media have just provably told flat-out lies, so many examples of that, then I'm hoping that people will come together from all sections of... one of the things which resonate with me about the Labour under Corbyn is for the many and not the few. The message from the Occupy movement in 2008 was the 99% about versus the 1%. I don't know if it's 1% or 0.1%. But there are a group of psychopaths who are a criminal gang that are inflicting these events, guiding these events. It is as bad as we would imagine. But for a mass movement, a catalyst to catch fire, that has to be that people wake up across the political spectrum and cast off the smears of the establishment. Because let's face it, anybody who questions anything is automatically labelled a conspiracy theory on purpose or attacked by guilt by association. So if you, well, as an example would be Jeremy Corbyn, that nobody would challenge necessarily what he was saying, but they would try and discredit him by saying, oh, well, once upon a time he met with some IRA people. Irrelevant, of course. and not necessarily a bad thing, but you get the idea that people are very reluctant to be seen to be a crazy conspiracy theorist.
But some people have, haven't they? A few people have actually, even quite well-known celebrities, people like that, have actually stuck their neck above the parapet. You know?
They have indeed, and well, first of all, it's normally ignored, but and the story dies a death. But we need more of those, and we need the different campaigns who are calling for transparency and accountability in this country to come together and not be afraid to be... Well, yes, we are saying it's a conspiracy. We can't tell you exactly how it happened, so we don't necessarily have our own theory of the actual mechanics.
See, the problem here is also is if people from the security services are involved, the Secret Service, of course, their names are all secret anyway, so you're not allowed to know.
Well, that's true, and yeah, we also know, of course, that the media is intensely infiltrated by the intelligence services.
Can you just run through some names of people who have actually stuck their neck out?
I mean, I do like that approach of trying to find people within the mainstream that have come out and challenged things. So there's people like Ed Asner, the famous US actor, was very supportive of the 9/11 families and critical to that. Some of the family members like William Rodriguez have been over to this country and spoken, and his testimony is very powerful because there's an eyewitness there to the events of the day, and his account cannot be true according to the official, or more to the point, the official version cannot be true given what he experienced and he's witnessed.
Well, he was also called the last man out, apparently, was one of the last people to actually get out before buildings collapsed.
So the other sort of little, Michael Meacher.
He was a Labour MP. Actually, up until fairly recently, one of the longest serving Labour cabinet ministers.
Yes, he was. Yeah. But what happened as a result of that? Nobody responded to say, Michael...
So what did Michael actually say?
He didn't... He basically said, I have my doubts about the... And then he lists all the elements of the official version, which he was struggling with. And if you go into the details of the intelligence and the defence failures and the nature of the tower collapses and so forth, then I can, you know, I share those questions. But the issue is that here's a UK MP that...
He was also a member of the Shadow Cabinet. Yes. He's a former cabinet minister.
Highly respected.
Privy councillor.
Yeah, but did anyone respond to his questions? No. In the media, amongst his colleagues and so forth. And maybe based on his experience, it explains, you know, we're back in, and I hesitate on the dates, but I'm pretty sure it's around 2008, about 10 years ago. 10 of us spent an hour in the House of Commons with Jeremy Corbyn going through all the evidence and case for that. He listened politely and acknowledged that there were serious questions to answer and was supportive, but that didn't translate into action. It didn't translate into public statements. So, and there have been vague other statements which are supportive of 9/11 truth, but at the same time, hasn't been carried forward into wider recognition.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And we'll be having more from Ian Neil in future weeks, where we'll talk about specific people, journalists, and what they've had to say about 9/11. Suggest interviewees for this show, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Thibault Devienne from Paris and Ian Neil, you just heard there. Also studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. Phone number 0117 909 6897. If you've got some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8pm. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, right here, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Most of us just sell out right away.